very ambitious project, okay? And the reason is that it involves many different topics, and I'll try to describe them today as part of the introduction. And well, let's see if we're able to cover everything. Even though we have 3 lectures, the material is so much that we will have to make something schematic, and I'll give many exercises, okay? So I'm sure that all of you will go this evening and work out all the exercises that you have for, because tomorrow I'll ask people to come to the Blackboard. Okay, so I'm going to talk about twisted string theory and perturbative jam mills. First, let me give you the motivation. And the motivation will go, in a sense, describing all the topics we have to cover. So this will be kind of motivations and outline. Let's start with perturbative QCD. Why do we want to do such a thing? Why do we want to compute scattering amplitudes in perturbation theory in QCD? Well, we all know that QCD is asymptotically free. So in the infrared, it's strongly coupled. But at very high energies, we can nicely describe the processes in perturbation theory. Where are we going to see that? Well, very soon, at the LHC, we're going to smash together protons, and then inside the protons, we will see gluons colliding at very high energies and, say, producing other gluons. And roughly speaking, at the mass of the Z boson, alpha strong is 1/10. So perturbation theory is useful. Now, you would say, well, but why do we want to do this still? Well, the reason is that we hope to see new physics, right? Well, but the new physics will be hidden in the background of the old physics. And what's the old physics? QCD. So we better understand very well the background before we understand the new physics. Otherwise, this big machine will give us numbers that we don't know how to interpret. But you might say, well, we have Feynman diagrams. Okay? Well, if you want to try, you are welcome. If you simply consider these scattering amplitudes with 6 gluons, you will have to compute of the order of 10 to the 5 Feynman diagrams. Okay? So if any of you wants to or have the energy to do that, you're welcome to do it. So we need new techniques. Okay. That's from an experimentalist point of view. We need to calculate these things, and we need new techniques. Now, from a more theoretical point of view, Hof, in 1974, was trying to understand QCD in the infrared. And he realized that, well, in the infrared, we don't have a dimensionless parameter where to span, because by dimensional transmutation, the coupling gets replaced by the lambda QCD. But he realized that, well, if you're looking at a UM theory, maybe you can think about N as a new parameter and perform an expansion in 1 over n. Well, if you look at Feynman diagrams, at each order in perturbation theory is given by a sum of terms with different dependences on n. So this program was not very easy to carry out, because the perturbation theory that we are very familiar with doesn't have a nice expansion in terms of 1 over n. But Etov realized that If you replace each gluon by a double line notation, you can naturally put everything together into something that has a nice 1 over n expansion if you define that hoof coupling that is this quantity, and you take the limit of large n and fix lambda t. Okay? Once you do that, any scattering amplitude has a natural decomposition in this form, where G is the genus of the diagram that you get by making the lines of the gluons fat. Okay, I'm filling up the holes. So this leads Hoof to conjecture that maybe QCD or any Jan-Mills theory might be related to a string theory. And why is that? Well, because from today's lecture, we know that the string theory is given in terms of a sum in different genera. Okay. Well, the idea was very nice, but then it took 23 years for the idea to be realized completely in one nice example. Do you know the example? Well, if you sum 23 years to that, gives 1997. And what happened then? Well, Maldacena told us that some string theory on ADS 5 cross S5 is precisely dual to a field theory, which is n equals force for Jan-Mills in 4 dimensions. So this was precisely the first nice example of a Hoof idea. However, the string theory is well behaved, or we can understand it very well, when this lambda is very large, when the Hoof coupling is very large. So the perturbation theory of this psi is out of reach. Okay? ADS will tell us what happens at very strong coupling, but it won't tell us what happens at weak coupling. So there is no hope to understand this from that point of view. Okay, fine. But we can understand non-perturbative aspects of field theories. That's great. Now let me describe something else that seems completely unrelated to all this, which is twister space. So this was developed by Penrose in 1967, okay? There are many ways to introduce twister space, but let me just give you one that is going to fit in this piece of the blackboard. Okay? So I'm sure that all of you wonder, when you learn complex analysis and you saw the power of using complex analysis in, say, fluid dynamics in 2 dimensions, okay, or just to solve Laplace equation in 2 dimensions, you saw the power of complex analysis when you can classify all the solutions of this by simply saying that f of z, z bar, has to be given by the sum of 2 pieces, each of them holomorphic and the other one anti-holomorphic. Then probably some of you wonder if you could translate the power of complex analysis into 4 dimensions. Okay? Well, the answer is yes, you can, but not in a very straightforward manner. Just to show you why, let's consider x1, x2, x3, and x4 to be the coordinates of our four-dimensional space. Now consider, well, we have four dimensions, so it's natural to think about a C2 structure. Let's try to define our C2 structure using these coordinates. So you get x, I make this choice. But some of you might say, no, I don't like that choice. I would choose something else. I would choose x2 to be here or x1 to be there. Okay? So it's clear that there is no unique choice. Now, what can we do? Let's try then to classify all possibilities of choices, all possible choices that live invariant the norm of this vector. Okay? Well, clearly, if you make an O4 rotation of the coordinates, x1 through x4, this is invariant by definition, right? This is a group that preserves this, this norm. But we want to classify all different structures, complex structures. So it's clear that if you have a function that is holomorphic in Z and Z tilde, and you perform a U2 transformation, then the function is still holomorphic in the same variables. Okay, so we have to model by this, and this is isomorphic to S2, which we just learned from Paul that we can call this CP1. Okay, very good. Now, at each point, in Minkowski space, well, let's make Minkowski space Euclidean and let's compactify it. So we have S4, okay? At each point of S4, we have a choice which is parameterized by CP1. So basically we have a CP1 bundle over S4, which is isomorphic to CP3. And this is what is called twister space. Okay? Very good. Any questions? Yes. Sorry? Oh, yes, because I want to classify all the inequivalent choices. Right? So if a function is holomorphic in Z and Z tilde, and I make a U2 transformation, it's still holomorphic in the new variables. And I want that to be the, that's the kind of things that I don't want to distinguish between them. I want the concept of holomorphicity to be just the same all the time. If I make any other choice parameterized by this, I turn a holomorphic function in one variable into a mixture of holomorphic and anti-holomorphic variables in the other set of variables. Okay? All right. So, but we also learned that CP3 in homogeneous coordinates can be written as a vector in C4. So let me just denote, use a funny notation for the coordinates in C4, lambda 1, lambda 2, mu 1, and mu 2. Okay? Now, this will be my CP1. The way you realize the vibration is the following. Remember that if you have a vector, x mu, even there, you can define a bispinner. We will discuss this later in more detail, but let me just define this here by using the Pauli matrices. Okay? Where sigma mu is a four vector of matrices made out of the identity and the Pauli matrices that we are familiar from quantum mechanics. Okay. So the vibration is given in such a way that these coordinates are determined by a point in Minkowski space by doing this contraction. So a given point in CP1 tells us a new reshuffling or a new definition of complex variables, mu1. Okay? So we will see this equation again coming from amplitudes of gluons. So remember this equation, please. Two more things I have to say. Well, one was that my discussion didn't fit in this piece of the blackboard, as I predicted. And the second one is that if you look at this equation, there are two consequences of this equation. One is the following. That if you fix Zi, a point in twister space, then what you find is that the set of xAA dot, or solutions of these equations, give you a null ray in Minkowski space. The second observation is the following. If you fix a point in Minkowski space, this equation will give you a CP1 inside twister space. So let me just, I'll draw it here because we will use it later. Suppose that I have twister space here. And I have Minkowski space here. So according to this, a point in twister space goes into a null ray in Minkowski space. And the second observation tells me that if I have a point here in Minkowski space, this goes into a CP1 in twister space. So we will use that, hopefully today, at the end of the lecture. So we still have to introduce one more topic that seems to be completely unrelated to all these other topics, which would be 4. And somebody has a question. Yes, hold on. Yes, that's something we will do many times here. We will just go from complex to real without mentioning, so you have to pay attention to that. Yes, that's a very good observation. Everything here makes more sense if I complexify Minkowski space. So this would really be a two-plane, which is called in the twister. Remember that now we are complexifying Minkowski space. It's an eight-dimensional object, right? And that line will become a null two-plane, which is called the beta plane in twister literature. But let me be hand-waving here and just stick to this picture, OK? The fourth topic is a topological string theory. OK? For a detailed description of the theory, we have to wait until Oguri comes, right? I think that will be next week. But in any case, let me tell you what is special about these guys. The string theory that we heard about this morning is usually defined in 10 dimensions or in 26 dimensions, OK? It has an infinite number of fields, okay? Now, there are some baby versions of a string theory. We which are called topological string theories. There are two of them. They are called the A and the B model. Okay. We will work with the B model. And it has two nice properties. One of them is that it has, or it admits as a target space, something that we will define later on, but it's called a super CP3. Okay. So now you know where Twistor space is going to enter here. It's going to enter through CP3 here as the target space of this theory. And the second thing is that it has a finite number of fields. Okay. And this finite number of fields will turn out to give us, in Minkowski space, or in space-time, the matter content, or the spectrum, of n equals 4 superjambians. Okay? And that's the way field theory will arise. Okay? So what's the goal of these lectures? One of the goals is to describe Twistor string theory . Okay, now you can tell me what Twistor string theory is, right? It's a string theory whose target space is Twistor space, right? We want this theory to be related to n equals 4 superjambians, so it has to be the V model on this super Twistor space. So remember, this is the goal, okay? We need n d5 frames in the story plus d1 instantons and show that this reproduces the perturbation theory. Let's call it perturbation P of the maximally supersymmetric jambians theory, which is n equals 4 superjambians. Okay? Along the way, we will learn about new techniques in field theory, in perturbation theory. We will learn about MHV diagrams. Connected diagrams. BCFW recursion relations. Quadruple cuts, and the ABDK conjecture. Okay? Well, these three things are techniques to calculate three-level amplitudes of gluons. This one is a technique to calculate one-loop amplitudes. And this is a conjecture about two and higher loop amplitudes, okay? Well, very good. So I hope everybody is extremely confused now. Have I succeeded? No? Well, if you know everything, then we can stop here. Sorry? Here, this M? No. M maximally. Maximals, yes, maximal supersymmetric jambians. This is the maximal amount of supersymmetry that you can have in a jam, in a field theory with a spin, with at most spin one particles. Okay, so let's start the part that I'm supposed to explain very well. Not just sketch things. well, this is not useful anymore. Our first point today are helicity amplitudes. Well, as I told you, we want to compute amplitudes of gluons, right? But each gluon carries the following information. It has a 4-vector that describes the momentum of the gluon, right? If the gluon was a scalar particle, then that would be it, right? But the gluon is not a scalar particle. So we also have to discuss or introduce its polarization vector. And of course, just to make our life interesting, we are discussing a non-abelian field theory with a gauge group UN. So it also carries a color index. And remember that the gluon is in the adjoint representation. Okay. Now, as you can imagine, if you have an amplitude of gluons, if you have an amplitude of gluons with all that data, you can construct an incredible amount of invariants. And your amplitude will generically be just a combination of those invariants. So that's at the heart of the complication. And most of those invariants are redundant, okay? So if we could find a way of reducing that redundancy in terms of new variables, maybe the amplitudes will look a little bit nicer. And that goes under the name of the helicity of the spinor helicity formalism. And the basic idea is the following. Consider the Lorentz group, okay? And now complexify. Well, if you complexify the Lorentz group, what you get is clearly two copies of SL2C. Okay? Now, finite dimensional representations of the Lorentz group will be given in terms, or will be classified in terms of the labels of the representations under this half of the group and this other half of the group. Okay? Well, the fundamental representations of these groups are the spinor representations. Okay? So let's say that this one is the left and this is the right. And let's call the spinors that transform under 1/2 0 negative chirality spinors. And thus in the 0.1/2 representation, positive chirality. Okay? Now we all know that these guys are just a complex vector that has two entries, right? So these are commuting spinors. So don't be confused with fermions. We're not discussing fermions here. These are just commuting spinors. So let me denote this two-component complex vector as lambda A, and this one as lambda tilde A dot. The tilde only means, is only there to remind us that this guy transforms under this group, and this one transforms under this group. There is nothing else to that dot there. OK? Very good. Now let's define an SL2C invariant tensor. So we have to define one for each. So let's call it AB, the one for this group, and epsilon A dot B dot, the one for this group. This is just the completely antisymmetric tensor in two dimensions, okay? And with this, we can construct Lorentz invariant inner products. Suppose that you have two negative chirality spinors, lambda and lambda tilde, or lambda prime, sorry. So we can define the inner product of these two guys, which is Lorentz invariant, as AB, lambda A, lambda prime B. Likewise, we can define the inner product of two positive chirality spinors by using the other invariant tensor. So please remember these two definitions, because we will use them all over the game, okay? Sometimes, if we are dealing with some gluons, some particular gluons, we will even, depending on how tired you are, you can even drop the lambdas and just say 1,2. That would mean that you are describing the inner product of the spinor corresponding to the particle 1 and the spinor corresponding to the particle 2. And even if you are even more tired, or if you are even lazier, you will drop the comma, and we will say just 1,2, okay? Using the tensor, just as a metric. Yes, I should have defined them with upper indices. But that's a good question. We lower and raise the indices with the invariant tensors. OK. Yes. What are what? Summation conventions. Oh, well, yes, very good. OK. So all indices. Go from 1,2, okay? And here I'm summing over indices. Now, this is, yes, okay, that's very important. What you're saying is basically, well, this is an anti-symmetric inner product. So if I define it the other way, I will get a minus sign. What did you say? Yes, they are commuting, yes, yes. But this inner product is anti-symmetric, right? If they were anti-commuting variables, this would be a plus sign, as you know very well, right? OK. But we are not interested in spin 1/2 particles. We're interested in vectors. So vectors are in this representation, 1/2, 1/2. So as we did before, we can take a 4 vector and decompose it or write it as a bispinor using Pauli matrices. Okay. Well, this can also be written in terms of a pair of products of the spinors. Let's call this prime. Okay. After all, this is just a 2x2 matrix. Okay. Now, something very important for us is the following. Remember that gluons on shell are massless, so the momentum describing the gluon is a null vector. Now, if you have a null vector, then we can always write the vector as he has a combination of two spinors, lambda and lambda tilde. Okay. Now, as an exercise, show that the inner product in Lorentz space with the Lorentz index, this contraction, is equal to the determinant of this matrix. Okay. I'm sure this is something that you have done many times, but if you haven't, it's a nice exercise. So the determinant being equal to zero is what allows us to write this in this form. Okay. Now, there is an important observation, which is the following. Given a momentum p, we cannot uniquely define lambda and lambda tilde. Can you see why? Well, if we have lambda and lambda tilde, and we rescale lambda and lambda tilde in this way, we get the same p. Okay? So these vectors, once you give p, are defined up to a scale, where t is in C star. Okay. Here we go with the discussion about the signatures, which is more or less what you were asking at some point. Okay. So suppose we are talking about, we are working on Minkowski signature. Okay. So here what happens is that, and say that P is real. So in this case, lambda and lambda tilde are both complex. Okay? But if P is real, they cannot be independent, right? If P is real, we need lambda tilde to be plus minus the complex conjugate of lambda in order to keep P real in this definition. Well, what's the choice of sign here? The choice of sign tells you whether the vector is a future or past directed vector, null vector. Okay. Now, one more signature that is going to be very interesting for us is the 2,2 signature, plus, plus, minus, minus. Here, the Lorentz group is SO2,2, okay? And it's isomorphic to SL2R cross SL2R, okay? So the spinors are real. And what's very important is that they are independent. There is no constraint if you consider real P. There is no constraint on lambda and lambda tilde because they are real. Okay. Very good. These are the two signatures that are going to be very useful for us. And let me define, well, it's not a definition, it's a derivation. Let me call it an observation. Suppose that you have two vectors. Two null vectors, P and Q. And you're given a decomposition of this form of P and a decomposition of Q of this form. Can you guess what's going to be the inner product of the two vectors? in terms of the spin-arena products? Yes, well, it can only be one thing. It can only be this times this, right? Well, because it has some given degree in lambda and lambda tilde and in lambda prime and in lambda tilde prime, and it's Lorentz invariant. And I told you that those are the Lorentz invariant inner products. So this is one more exercise to check that this is true. Okay. Very good. All right. Let's move on and describe the gluon. After all, that's what we want to compute, right? We want to compute amplitudes of gluons. So we have the momentum and the polarization vector. We now know that we can describe both vectors as bi-spinners. But is there any way we can encode the information of the polarization vector in terms of these two spinners, lambda and lambda tilde? Well, the answer is yes, if we're given the helicity. In addition, we're given the helicity of the gluon. Let's call it Hi. So if you're giving lambda A, let's call it lambda I, lambda I tilde, and the helicity, then you can recover this information. Let me tell you how. So the momentum, we already said that is given by. So here is going to be, the indices are going to be a little bit confusing, because I denotes the ith gluon, and we have A in A dot. So we have to be careful with everything. OK, so this is a momentum. Now, I claim that the polarization vector can be written in the following form. If it's a gluon of plus helicity, then this vector is given by the following bi-spinner. Where eta is an arbitrary reference spinner. Okay. If the gluon has negative helicity, remember that there is an index I here, then we can write this as okay. Again, eta and eta tilde are arbitrary reference spinners. Okay. Now you might say, well, but how can you introduce just a reference spinner? Doesn't the choice of the spinner matter? How can this be? Well, let me remind you that the polarization vectors are supposed to do two things. One of them is that they are supposed to be transverse, okay, which means that the inner product with the momentum of the particle has to be zero. Okay, now you can see that this is straightforward from the definitions we have, right? Any of these two vectors contracted with this one by using this is going to give me 0, because this inner product is anti-symmetric. So the inner product of a vector with itself is 0. Is that clear? Well, maybe let me write it again. So if we take this inner product here, we're going to get, just using this, and using this formula here, we're going to get, say, for the plus helicity, we get eta with lambda, and then lambda tilde with lambda tilde over eta with lambda. These two cancel. But what is important is that we have lambda tilde with lambda tilde. And I told you that this inner product is anti-symmetric. So we get 0. Okay. Now, the other thing that is interesting about polarization vectors is the following. Under a gauge transformation, what are they supposed to do? Well, they are not supposed to stay invariant. They can change, but they can change only by something proportional to the momentum of the particle, okay? So under a gauge transformation, this polarization vector can do this, okay? Now, there is one more exercise for you. This one is actually very interesting. It's to check the different choices of eta or eta tilde are gauge transformations. Okay. Can you see right away why is this true? Well, let me give you a hint. Consider a change in eta, okay? Now, eta is a 2-vector, right? Well, if it's a vector in a 2-dimensional space, it can be written as a linear combination of any 2 vectors that are independent, right? So I can always find alpha and beta, 2 numbers, in such a way that any vector, in particular this change in eta, is given by eta and lambda, okay? That's all the hint. If you use that, you should be able to prove that the change is precisely a gauge transformation. Okay. So now let's talk about the scattering amplitudes. We have been talking about the gluons, but let's now talk about the amplitude itself. Yes. Now, eta is a fixed reference spinor that you choose, so it has to be different from the lambda. Well, in a sense, that would be a singular gauge transformation, but the reference spinor is something that you choose. So you always choose it to be different from that. Yes, it's a singular choice. So you have to keep eta different from lambda. It's arbitrary, so you can always choose it or tune it to be different from lambda. Any more questions? You can choose a different one. Yes. Actually, the way you choose it will make the amplitudes very simple or very complicated. So it's kind of an art to choose it. Okay, so suppose that you consider the scattering amplitude of m particles. As we said before, if they are scalars, the amplitude is just a function of the momenta. And not only that, it's going to be a function of just the inner product of them. It cannot depend on anything else. It has to depend on the inner products of them. Okay. If it's just an amplitude made of scalar particles. Now, if you have particles with a spin, the amplitude not only depends on the gluon, but it also depends on the wave function of the particle. In the case of the gluon, it's a polarization vector, right? Now, in a Feynman diagram expansion of this, we know that the wave functions will appear only linearly. So this function is a multilinear function in depth size, okay? Now we find a nice surprise, which is the following. In terms of the spin or helicity formalism, the description of any particle with a spin is simply given, again, by the lambdas and the helicity of the particle. Okay. Now, the reason I mentioned that this is multilinear in size is the following. If you look here, if the particle has positive helicity, right, it has a given scaling in terms of lambda and lambda tilde. If you change lambda and lambda tilde, if you rescale both of them, okay, remember that in order to keep the momentum invariant, you have to rescale lambda and lambda tilde by t and t inverse lambda I tilde. If you do this rescaling, what's going to happen if the gluon has positive helicity? Well, since the amplitude is multilinear, what's going to happen is that the amplitude is going to pick up a factor of one over t squared, right? If the gluon has positive helicity. If the gluon has negative helicity, it's going to pick a factor of t squared. Okay? Well, a given rescaling can be translated into a nice equation, right, that tells us that the function is homogeneous of some degree in those variables under that rescaling. And the equation I want to write is the following. Okay, the difference in sign tells us the difference in the t, in the way t rescales, okay, in the way each of the lambdas rescale with t of a given amplitude. Is equal to well. According to the discussion I told you, I mean, this derivation, given the fact that the amplitudes are multilinear in the wave functions, and the wave functions scale in the way I told you, we conclude that here there is a minus 2, the helicity of the ith particle. Okay? This is a minus. So this is an equation that is going to be very useful for us tomorrow when we try to map fields in twisted space to fields in Minkowski space. Okay, very good. But gluons not only have momentum and polarization vectors, but they also have a color structure, a color index. What can we do with this color index? Well, we're dealing with UN. We know that all the information about the group structure is hidden, or not hidden, but given in the structure constants, right? Well, every interaction vertex in the gauge theory will involve the structure constants. If we are able to write the structure constants in a nicer way, we will be able to carry out the color decomposition of a truth in a very simple manner. So I'm sure that all of you agree that up to a numerical factor that I'm not going to write, this is true. Any objections to that formula? OK. Well, let's take this formula. Let's also take the fact that these Hermitian matrices, the generators, form a basis of Hermitian matrices. And let me denote this, or let me express that in this form. OK. So I want to use these two facts to carry out something that is known as a color decomposition. Okay. So the simplest way of doing it is just by doing it with diagrams. So this tells us that if you have an interaction vertex with a structure constant, we can always write it in this form, where this represents the traces, okay? So don't confuse this with a three-level amplitude being written as a in terms of two one-loop amplitudes. That's not the idea. This is just a diagrammatic expansion of the color structure of the amplitude. Okay? So whenever you see a vertex like this, you can replace it by this combination. What does this one tell you? Well, this one tells you that if you have something like this coming in, let me reverse the arrows here. OK. So we have ij bar, and then you have k and m bar. So this is this side of the equation. OK. We are summing over a's. The other side of the equation tells us that we can replace this by just a double arrow with j bar going here, combined with k, and m bar here combined with I. OK? Now, as another exercise, try to do the following. Consider this diagram that contributes to a five-loop amplitude. OK? This is just one diagram for the five-loop amplitude. First, use this rule to replace all these vertices by these ones, right? Once you have done that, you will end up with something like this. right? Now you can use this other one to replace these pieces by connected pieces, okay? So I want you to show that this can be written as a single trace one, two, three, four, and five, plus permutations. But just single trace, guys. Okay? If you do this, then you will believe what I'm gonna tell you now, that at tree level, any amplitude of gluons, of n gluons, that again has all this structure, for each gluon, is given, well, if we want, we can be very precise and write the Jahn-Mills coupling. We have a Jahn-Mills coupling to the power n minus 2 here. We have a delta function of momentum conservation, which in terms of the spinors, we write in this form, okay? Then we have a trace of T A1 up to T AN of something that now only depends on lambda I tilde, and HI. Okay? Plus all possible permutations. By possible, I mean all inequivalent permutations, right? Because if we take a cyclic permutation, the trace is invariant. So a cyclic permutation should not be allowed. So basically, this is a set of permutations of n numbers mod out by Zn. And these objects here are called partial amplitudes. Well, if you want the full name, they are called color order partial amplitudes. And why are they called color order? Well, the reason is that if you see, this amplitude is computed, it's just the sum of all Feynman diagrams that came from this kind of decompositions and where you keep a given order of the gluons, okay? So you look for all Feynman diagrams where gluons 1 through 5 enter in this cyclic order, okay? Another diagram where 1 and 2 are permutated here would be a contribution to another partial amplitude. But what is important about these guys is that they are colored order. They don't depend on the gauge of the color index, okay? They are gauge invariant objects. And it turns out that these are the guys that we can compute very easily. Well, that we now know how to compute very easily. Okay, so enough of just definitions. Let me actually show you some amplitudes that were computed by Park and Taylor. Or more precisely, they computed these amplitudes up to 4 gluons or 5 gluons, and then they conjectured the general form of the amplitudes for any number of gluons. Later on, Behrens and Gill proved these formulas, okay, using recursion techniques, but we won't get into that here. I'm just gonna tell you what these amplitudes are at this point. These are also known as MHV amplitudes. where MHB stands for maximally helicity violating amplitudes. Okay. So the idea is the following. Consider an amplitude where you have gluons. Remember that now we are only talking about these partial amplitudes. Okay? I'm not going to say this anymore. I'm just going to talk about amplitudes. But you should remember that we're talking about color order partial amplitudes. It's just that it's too long to say it. And that's why I'm allowed to just give a given order of the gluons here. Okay? Now consider the case where, as in field theory, we take all particles to be outgoing and all of them to have plus helicity. Okay? So we are talking about this amplitude. Now, I'm going to introduce this shorthand notation. 1 plus means lambda 1, lambda 1 tilde, h1. OK? So 1 plus means everything that is here. So we have 2 plus all the way up to n plus. So it's amazing that one can actually compute an infinite series of amplitudes. And the answer turns out to be 0. OK, so you say, well, fine, it's 0. Let me try something else. So let's try to make one of the gluons, let's say the ith or the jth gluon. Let's make it a minus, right? So we have 1 plus, 2 plus, all the way up to the jth gluon, which is minus, and then everything else plus. Well, you go ahead and compute this amplitude, and you find 0 again. Then you say, well, fine. So Jahn-Mills is a trivial theory. It doesn't have any scattering amplitudes. Well, no. You continue, right? Say somewhere here is the gluon, is the ith gluon, and you also make it a minus helicity gluon. So you have 1 plus, 2 plus, all the way up to the ith gluon, which is minus. Everything else is plus. You go to the jth gluon, it's minus. Everything else is plus. And then you find that the answer is not 0. But it's surprisingly simple. If you try this computation for 5 gluons, only 5 gluons, and you express this in terms of vectors of momenta and polarization vectors of the gluons and the color structure and everything, you can very easily write the answer in just 100 pages, okay? Using a very small font. So you can guess that the answer will not, I'm not going to write that answer, but I'm going to write the answer that Park and Taylor conjecture, and it's the following. Now you remember what this means, right? Ij to the fourth, yes, ij. So I told you that I was going to be lazy, and I'm going to say that lambda I comma lambda j is just lambda ij, okay? Divided by 1, 2, 2, 3, n minus 1, n, n 1. That's it. That's the answer. Amazing, right? Since unbelievably simple. Even something more amusing is the following fact. There is a 4 here, right? And I told you that we were going to discuss the maximally supersymmetric field theory. How many supersymmetries are there? four supersymmetries. Well, it turns out that that four comes from the four supersymmetries. I also have to say that at tree level, there is no difference between QCD and, in terms of amplitudes of gluons, the amplitudes in n equals 4 superjammials agree with the amplitudes in QCD. Try to think why. Tomorrow I'll tell you the answer. But try to think today why the two things are equal. Let me write the statement. At tree level, an amplitude of gluons in n equals 4 supergermials equals an amplitude of gluons in QCD. So QCD at tree level is supersymmetric. Okay. So, but I haven't told you why these amplitudes are called maximally helicity violating amplitudes. So let me tell you why. Suppose that in a physical process, you throw in three gluons of minus helicity, and you get out a bunch of plus helicity gluons. This is what I would call a maximally helicity violating object, right? Amplitude. Because you have all minus helicities coming in and only plus helicities going out. Well, have I told you what this answer is? What this amplitude is? Yes, I told you. Why? Because now you can apply a parity transformation on these legs and make these arrows outgoing, right? If you do that, the helicity gets reversed. So this amplitude is exactly equal to the first one I drew there, where you have all pluses. So what's the answer for this process? It's just zero. Well, let's say that you don't want to violate helicity maximally. You want to have three minus helicity gluons, and they go into pluses with one minus. Well, again, that's the second one we computed there, or I showed you what it is, and it's also zero. Well, then you go to the next case, and this is not zero. Okay? So this is the first time that helicity is violated. So that's why these are called maximally helicity violating amplitudes. Okay? Note that there is something funny which happens for four gluons, right? If you only have four gluons, these MHB amplitudes are actually something that preserve helicity, right? This is something I heard Edwards in one seminar, and that's interesting. Okay. Well, so you see that you go increase the number of minuses, okay? And you get the Park-Taylor formula, which is very nice. Then you're very happy and you are very encouraged and say, okay, fine. I'm gonna add one more minus to the story, okay? So you go ahead and you add one more minus. Of course, it's not zero. Okay. And it turns out that you have to be really smart to compute it. And you find a complete mess. It's a very complicated object that depends on both kind of spinor inner products. You see that this one is a beautiful object that only depends on one of the two inner products. So we can call in Minkowski space, remember that the lambda tilde is related to the lambda by complex conjugation. So we can think about the lambda as holomorphic variables and the lambda tildes as anti-holomorphic variables. If we use that terminology, this object would be holomorphic. So the MHB amplitudes are holomorphic, while anything else is just a non-holomorphic object, is a mess, and there is nothing we can do about it, it seems. If we do what, sorry? Yes. Yes, yes, so here they are. There are the two things. The miracle is that somehow the anti-holomorphic part doesn't enter here. Somehow, magically, it disappears. If you want to compute something off-shell, now off-shell, that would be more complicated. Indeed, you would have, that's the way these things were proven in the 80s, by using off-shell recursion relations. But that's another story, and it's complicated. So I don't want to get into that. In any case, we now have, and hopefully we will discuss, a new technique to calculate these amplitudes, which is very simple. Okay. Okay, so let's see. So in the final 15 minutes, let's discuss a nice property of these amplitudes. Let's try to check that these MHB amplitudes are conformal invariant. And this would be the way to connect to twister space. Okay, so first we have to write the generators of the conformal group in terms of these spinors that we have, lambda, lambda tilde, right? So let's write the Lorentz generators. Okay. It's not difficult to see that it has to be something like this, because there must be three of them, right? It has to be, so therefore this guy has to be symmetric. It can only depend on the lambdas, and it has to have a scaling zero when you rescale lambda. So this is all it can be. The other Lorentz generator, it would be in terms of the lambda tildes. Okay, so these are nice generators. Now the momentum generator is naturally given by this. Okay, now we have to work out the other generators of the conformal group. Well, let's start by realizing that the commutator of the dilatation operator with the momentum operator is equal to P, okay? So this means that P has dimension 1, which makes very natural to give dimensions to lambda and lambda tilde. One half, okay? Now the commutator of the dilatation operator with a generator of special conformal transformations is minus IK, which means that the dimension of k is equal to minus 1. Now, how can we make up an operator k of dimension minus 1 out of k out of lambda and lambda tilde if k is supposed to be a vector? Well, I guess the natural guess is that it would have to be a second order differential operator. Okay. What about the dilatation operator? Well, we can find it because it shows up in the commutator of k with p, which is given by the following expression. Okay. Well, as you can guess, I'll leave it as an exercise to check that D given by now comes the funny part satisfies the algebra. There is just these two there. That's very annoying. Since we don't have time to do it today, I'll also leave it as an exercise to check our MHV amplitude, which is a full thing, right? So we have to write the momentum conservation delta function. Let's call it ij. So let's change these indices to kk. So the MHV amplitude ij, where we should also call this mostly plus MHV amplitude, meaning that almost all the gluons have plus helicity except for I and j, which have minus helicity. It's just a formula I wrote before. Okay. Check that this is conformally invariant. Okay. Very good. So we end today by the following observation. The observation is that this representation of the conformal group is a weird representation. It's a very weird thing, right? It has first order differential operators. It has just a polynomial here, second order differential operator, and an operator that is not even homogeneous, okay? So that's a very strange representation of the conformal group. On the other hand, we know that the conformal group in Minkowski space is SO4, 2. If you complexify it, it's SO6, which is isomorphic to SU4. Well, if it's complexified, it's SL4C. Okay? And this has a nice action on C4. Okay, in terms of just linear operators. So how can we get such a description, such a natural representation from this very strange representation? Well, tomorrow we will see that the way to do it is the following. We take every lambda tilde that we see, and we replace it by its conjugate variable in the sense of a Fourier transform, okay? Of course, the inverse is also true. Okay. Now, tomorrow we will do it, but if you still have time and energy, you can try to check that once you do this, let me just tell you one of the miracles that happened. Try to see why this is true. The two is gone. Okay. Well, if you're checking that that is true, you might as well check that these guys go into first order differential operators that they were. So this one stays the same because it's just in terms of the lambdas, and we are not modifying the lambdas. Okay, so up to now, everything are very nice first order differential operators. Well, this one goes into, okay, and finally, K goes into this. And then we got a nice representation of SL4C in terms of first order differential operators. So this is the action. This is a natural representation on the space defined by lambda 1, lambda 2, mu 1, and mu 2, which, as you hopefully remember by now, was precisely the definition we gave of a twister. If you remember at the beginning of the lecture, we defined twister space basically as CP3 with homogeneous coordinates lambda 1, lambda 2, mu 1, and mu 2. So this is the point where we make the connection. And tomorrow, we will start the lecture by trying to see how these amplitudes look like in twister space once you perform this twister transform. And that's the key. Well, this will be the key later on that will allow us to compute any amplitude with any number of minus helicity gluons. Even the mess that I told you before, we will be able to compute it explicitly, very easily. OK? OK, so see you tomorrow.